Good evening and welcome to another edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. For tonight's cast, we're going to be discussing the topics relating to the legal side of the game industry, specifically when it comes to crowdfunding and some of the challenges that come up when you commit to either a Kickstarter, Indiegogo, or whatever kind of campaign and what happens after that. And joining me tonight, he is the head of legal over at Patreon, and he's also done work when it comes to game development and this kind of topic. Please welcome Colin Sullivan.
Thank you so much for having me, Josh.
It's a pleasure to have you on today, Colin. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am doing great. It's definitely been a very interesting year, to say the least, at least for mine, when it comes to Game Wisdom's growth and trying to actually use my own Patreon crowdfunding to help support myself, which I am sure you've heard that story a whole lot since joining Patreon.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But I'm sure we have a lot to talk about, especially when it comes to the legal side of the game industry, because as I was just talking to someone about this the other day, by the time of this recording, we were talking about why or how there isn't a lot of discussions regarding marketing and what it means to work in the game industry. I'm sure there's even less out there about some of the legal challenges and hurdles that can happen, especially with the rise of Kickstarter and just all-around crowdfunding options.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think it's also important to know your limitations when it comes to some of these legal questions. It's you know, it's the same way that a developer would probably hire an artist or a sound designer or something to do specific aspects of the game development. It's okay to outsource a lot of these legal questions too. There's some very good attorneys who work in this space. I used to, although now I'm working full time at Patreon, but you can get good advice for a relatively reasonable price, and it's good to make sure that you do that. And also, for the sake of clarity, if I give any advice on this podcast that is not legal advice, just talking about like the space generally.
Yep, and for my end, I am certainly not a lawyer, so please do not take anything that I say either as legal counsel. Yeah. But to get things started, Colin, as I said, you are currently the head of legal at Patreon, but in terms of your background when it comes to the game industry, could you go into a little bit of detail about that?
Yeah. So I started off in the game industry by starting a solo practice and was really focused on game developers, and especially game developers that were using crowdfunding. This was back in 2012 and 2013, so it was when Kickstarter was just really hitting its stride in game development, and we were seeing a lot of indie game developers starting to get very successful Kickstarters and suddenly being thrust in a position of having a little bit more responsibility and backers to satisfy and a lot of legal issues around all of that. And so when I started my practice, I really wanted to work with those developers, and just went out there and started talking to game developers and getting clients in that space. And it was a lot of fun to do that for a few years, and also diversified out of that slightly into indie publishing at the same time, and did both of those in parallel up until I joined Patreon full time about 2 years ago.
And for those of you listening, Colin was introduced to me by my friend and co-host for our live show, Robert Leach. You guys used to work at Indie Voyage together.
Yeah, so that was a very fun sort of side project that we both did for a few years there, and unfortunately have just recently started to wind down. But it was really great to work with developers, not just on the legal side of things, but also thinking a little bit more deeply about how they structure the business of game development, and really thinking about the responsibilities that you get when you successfully crowdfund in a game.
And I want to go back to what you said a minute ago, Colin, regarding how developers at least when they, or at least as we've seen, when it comes to Kickstarter and crowdfunding, can tend to overwhelm themselves. I have spoken to several developers in the past, and even one publisher, and we've talked about a lot of the logistical side of the crowdfunding. You mentioned, of course, you know, goals, rewards, and we've talked before about the challenges of how do you design a campaign? How do you decide what rewards to use? How are you going to produce those rewards and so on? So I think it's going to be very interesting to talk about sort of the legal side and what happens when things don't work out well. And I think I got the perfect first question. I think this is either going to be a very short or a very long answer from you, Colin. But here you go. When, or as you said, when you got started in looking at things from the legal side with Kickstarter and crowdfunding, that was 2012, 2013. And as we said, that is obviously kind of the quote unquote gold rush period of Kickstarter, thanks to Double Fine, Uber Entertainment, so many more developers jumping on Kickstarter to get their dream idea made. And of course, as we've seen, for every major success, there have been many times more failures. Be it from campaigns that overpromise, they underdelivered, or in some cases, they just didn't deliver at all. And one thing that has sprouted up several times in the last few years from disgruntled fans and betrayed consumers is the idea of holding developers liable when this happens. And I spoke to a few friends about this. I think this was like way back in 2014, 2015. Just as we were really getting started with the podcast side of things. And the question is, when it comes to this kind of crowdfunding, be it Indiegogo, Kickstarter, Patreon, whatever, are or is there any kind of like legal ramification if the developer says, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and that never happens?
Yeah. So I think that this probably will err on the long side of the answer, but I'll try to structure this as easily as possible, and we'll walk through a few parts of it. So I think the short answer is that, yes, there's definitely potential liability there, especially for I'm actually going to differentiate very quickly Patreon from Kickstarter and Indiegogo and other sorts of services like that. At Patreon, we've actually moved away from talking about ourselves as a crowdfunding service because it's really more about delivering ongoing value to people who you have a close relationship with. So now we're calling it a membership platform. So in that sense, I actually, while there is potentially you know obligations that you're making to the people that are paying you a subscription, it's an ongoing thing. So the chance of a mismatch there is far lower. You're generally not raising a giant pile of money to then go build something that has been untested. You're funding the ongoing development of something you've already put a ton of work into and you've already gotten a big following for, and it's usually very small discrete deliverables. So going back to the Kickstarter, Indiegogo sort of classic crowdfunding side of it, I mean, there's absolutely potential liability. You're basically getting a giant pile of money, telling people you're going to give them something for that giant pile of money, and then going out there and hoping that you can execute on that. As to like the actual ways that that could potentially come back to you, that's where it gets a little bit trickier. So far, what we've seen is for some there have been a very, very small number of what I would call bad faith examples where it just looks like the person raising the money through crowdfunding was obviously not taking this seriously, maybe even fraudulent in how they raised that money and what they did with that money. And in those circumstances, we've actually seen attorney generals in various states bring consumer protection actions against some of these people raising this money. So that's sort of like the extreme end of the example where, you know, you're taking the money and then you're literally going to Vegas with it or, you know, something along those lines. And it's just very obviously bad faith. But, you know, there's intermediate steps towards that. So we have seen some people bring small claims or attempt to bring class actions. and things like that, especially larger backers. You know, somebody put $10,000 into something and they feel personally wronged, it's very easy to do a small claims, to bring that to small claims court and try to get that money back. At this point, I'd actually like to shift to the other side of, like, how do you avoid that potential liability? And this is where there's both, like, the legal answer and the broader answer. So to start with the broader answer, a lot of this is about setting expectations and communication and even just designing your goals and your awards from the start. If you're a game developer and half of the work that you're doing after you raise money on Kickstarter is delivering t-shirts and art books and things like that, you've probably done something wrong.
Yes.
That's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to raise money to make a game. So at the very start, just think very carefully about the rewards that you're promising. Think very carefully about what the stretch goals are and all of those things, and try to focus as much as possible on the core deliverable product that you actually know how to do. You know, you're a game developer, you know how to make a game. Try to focus on that.
Yeah. And then, I just want to interject there for a second. Another very important tip. If you are going to go the route of any kind of physical or secondary reward that you're not familiar with, as in, as you said, a t-shirt, I've seen dice, necklaces, coats, figurines, whatever, take the time to examine the three main areas that's going to go into that. That is design the actual physical good, the manufacturing of the good, and of course the logistics of shipping and sending it around the world. Because I have spoken to several developers and people who've worked with either tabletop or card games in the past, and those three areas can easily come back to bite you if you don't do the proper research.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think especially like the logistics portion of that, you know, as game developers, shipping code, you're not used to physical logistics. It is another beast entirely. So moving on to like the sort of the expectation setting and the communication around that, there's been examples of developers and just Kickstarter campaigns in general that have spectacularly exploded, just no deliverable, no value coming out of it, and yet not really seeing any backlash. Yeah. And the reason why is because the people involved were so good about setting expectations, about communicating constantly and updating those expectations, that people understood the process. You know, backers aren't stupid. They understand what they're getting into to some degree. You know, maybe if you have a campaign that goes just completely viral and gets a lot of people that you weren't expecting and they think of it as, you know, a done deal, that might be a separate issue. But, you know, most of the time people understand that they're putting money into something and they have a hope as to what they're going to get, but they also understand what it's going to take to get from A to B there. And so if in that journey from A to B, if you're communicating what's going on, where the holdups are, why things aren't going according to schedule, and all of those things, and the things you're doing to address those problems, both from your, you know, both from a personal stress level, just in terms of not having people being angry at you, and from a legal side of, again, not having people being angry at you and willing to sue you, it's going to just lead to such better results there that, you know, customer support and communication is probably the most important thing when it comes to legal issues. And there's actually a great analogy in malpractice for doctors. Doctors who have great bedside manners have a far lower rate of malpractice lawsuits than doctors who have poor bedside manners. And it's not because the doctors who are nice people are better doctors. It's just because they're nice people, and so people don't want to sue nice people. And so if you're a nice person and you make sure that people understand what's going on, even if it goes horribly, horribly wrong, most people are going to be okay with that.
Yeah. And I guess from my side of things, and from talking to developers, in many cases, it's better to deliver bad news than it's to deliver no news at all. Especially, as you said, Colin, that if you just got, you know, 500,000 or even more money and you just disappear for 6 to 12 months, people are going to be very suspect as to what's happening. And some of the best Kickstarter or post-Kickstarter developments I've seen over the last few years have come from developers who have consistently kept people updated as to what's going on, what they're doing. Even, as you said, even when something goes horribly wrong, if you're still conveying that information to people and letting them know that you're not just, that you're not just, you know, sitting away on a private island, you know, sipping martinis on the beach, people are going to be more willing to forgive you or more willing to accept that something has gone wrong. And it just very quickly, two really great examples that we've talked about before on the podcast would be the Darkest Dungeon Kickstarter and post Kickstarter from Red Hook Games. And of course, Interversion Software with Prison Architect and how they pretty much kept everybody updated as to what's happening. And again, I guess here's a question for you, Colin. When it comes to this kind of communication, is there like a magic number or a formula for how often you should communicate to people? Or is it just, you know, just try to get on a regular schedule and keep to it?
Yeah, so I think there's going to be two separate questions in, or two separate answers in there in terms of, is this just normal updates or is something bad happening? Mm-hmm. If it's just normal updates, then it's really a broader question of like, how much do you want to spam your backers and things like that? You know, probably something in the realm of like once per month, maybe a little bit more frequently if there's more going on or it's immediately after the end of the campaign or close to the release. Probably not less than once per month, but you know, if it happens to be hard to get an update out, it's probably not the end of the world either. When things are going wrong, then I think you potentially might want to do it more frequently. And as I mentioned, it's sort of like about bringing people on that journey with you. It's not going to be, oh, we raised all this money and then instantly there's no deliverable. It's going to be, we had this delay, we had this setback. And then if they see those things happening over the course of 6 months, and then at the end of that 6 months, you say, okay, realistically, we're not going to deliver this, but maybe we can deliver something else that's not exactly what we promised in the original campaign, but it's something. That's at least, you know, that gets you most of the way. And people have gone on that journey with you and have changed their expectations along that journey. Plus, you might get good feedback. You might get somebody who wants to help you out, or, you know, maybe a publisher will reach out and say, hey, we've seen that you're having trouble on this. Could we, you know, help fund the rest of the development? Or, you know, who knows what might happen, but at least that way it's out there in the universe and you can get that feedback.
It's not viewed as kind of like a back alley deal or some grand conspiracy when you're the one basically ahead of the news, in the matter of speaking.
Exactly.
Yep.
So I want to transfer briefly to the actual legal portion of that answer, and then we can jump into other questions.
Sure.
So the actual legal portion of the answer in terms of how you protect yourself from liability, there's really one main answer there that protects you in the vast majority of situations, and that's to form an entity. So if you are raising money on Kickstarter as an LLC or a corporation, then that's the entity that's responsible. You know, if you're in a lawsuit, if somebody's bringing you to small claims court and you have personally been raising that money on Kickstarter, you may or may not win. You know, that's going to get into the specifics of how you handled the money, what you promised, all those things. And, you know, you're ultimately going to be dealing with all that after the fact with an attorney or, you know, trying to figure it out yourself. You just don't want to be there. You want to have raised that money through an entity. And so if and when there's any issues at all, you have that entity that can take that lawsuit. And, you know, if you actually have run out of money in that entity, then there's nothing left to get and there's no reason for it. And if there is any money left, then that's the limit to how much you can potentially lose. You know, you're not going to lose your savings or your house or your car or anything else. It's limited to that entity. And it's a really strong firewall between your personal assets and the assets of anybody else working with you and what has been put into that entity, it takes quite a bit to get through that. And there's a technical legal term for it called piercing the corporate veil. But, you know, it's going to take some pretty serious bad faith, like you taking all the money and going to Vegas for it to not be useful.
Mm-hmm. I hate to say it, but I think we did hear of a story of someone doing just exactly that with one of the Kickstarter campaigns. But
yeah, there's definitely been a few interesting stories.
Oh, yes. And going back to what you said a minute ago regarding updates and like once a month, I would agree with you on that. Typically, once a month seems to be a really solid benchmark to set for yourself in terms of keeping people updated. Even like if we're talking like post Kickstarter, even for developers who go on early access, it's still important to communicate to your people, even if you don't have a new build ready, just to let them know what's going on, what's happening. And typically, at least from my side of things, when I see a Kickstarter or early access or any kind of crowdfunding campaign go off the rails, the first thing that I notice is that the updates just stop, or they slow down to a massive crawl. I'm talking like an update in January and then nothing until August of that year.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'll actually add to that a little bit as well, because you mentioned early access and releases for, you know, new builds and such. If you're at the point where you are, you know, out there in early access, somebody's playing your beta and you're releasing builds, optimize for short build releases. Mm-hmm. You know, try to do one every month or so, even faster than if you can manage it. You know, that's not even just a legal issue. That's just makes good sense to get builds out there faster so that people can give you feedback. You know, there might be an occasional thing where you're implementing this massive new feature and it just isn't going to be ready for 3 months or something, but you know, maybe throw a few bug fixes in there every once in a while and release that every couple of weeks. You know, it's just get something out there.
Yeah, and I would say to add to that, from what I've seen, I've spoken to some developers about, like 3 to 4 weeks per build seems to be a pretty solid average, but try not to go overboard, like once a week, a brand new build, because chances are that will probably just overwhelm you unless you have a very big company of people working on that game.
Yeah. Although I will just say as a counterexample, I know that Vlambeer famously did that with Nuclear Throne, and that seemed to work out quite well for them. So if you can do it, more power to you.
Yeah, but don't kill yourself if you can't.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, getting back to Kickstarter and kind of the legal side of crowdfunding, there is a kind of a part two to the question I asked you regarding legal ramifications. And this is the weird thing is that when we first talked about this several years ago, it kind of got an answer already. But this is the idea of selling shares, or basically when someone donates to a Kickstarter, they get some kind of ownership over that Kickstarter. As you know, I buy, you know, 5 shares or I own stock in this Kickstarter succeeding. And when we first spoke about this like 4 or 5 years ago, there was nothing along those lines. But obviously over the last 2-3 years, we've seen the rise of FIG, which, if for those of you listening who don't know what we're talking about, FIG is the, I guess, the newest crowdfunding platform, and what separates it from Kickstarter and Indiegogo is that people have the actual option to invest in whatever project they're donating to. And the investment side usually requires investments at like things like $500 to $1,000 plus, and when you do that, you literally own stock in that game. And if it succeeds and it sells, you will actually earn money based on the amount of ownership you have in that. And I guess for you, Colin, like, as you said, dealing with the Kickstarter and the legal side of crowdfunding, what do you think about that as being like offering someone like ownership or investing in your product?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's also useful to think about the underlying structure of all this. So, this was actually part of an act that was passed back in 2012 called the Jobs Act. And the idea was to expand who could offer securities, which are, you know, basically just shares in a company, and who could purchase those to make it easier for smaller companies to be able to do that. And it actually took a really, really long time for any of this to get off the ground. It's only in the last year or two that we've really started to see this happen effectively. But the idea was that we have all these crowdfunding platforms that are doing this purely for rewards, so why don't we also do it for shares? And, you know, Kickstarter and Indiegogo have done it very effectively, where you're not buying any ownership in the company. You know, people might think that they were. They were definitely quite pissed off about Oculus when that suddenly became a very valuable business, and you know, they had all felt like they invested, but of course they just really done a pre-order. But you know, the fact of it is that you're not buying shares on Kickstarter or Indiegogo. That's just standard pre-ordering, you know, getting some sort of reward for your money. But now there is this new wave of crowdfunding platforms that are applying these new security standards that were released through the Jobs Act. And that does give you the chance to invest. Typically, the trade-off, though, is that you're not getting anything cool directly as part of that. So, you know, you might be putting in money to invest in something, but you're not getting the exclusive, you know, model or character in the game named after you, or whatever it might be. And of course, you have to pay usually quite a bit more. I know with Fig, I think they start their investments at $500 or something around there. It's I know they it's slightly more significant than your average Kickstarter if you're actually investing in the game. But I mean, the upside of that is that you do get a return for it. So I think, you know, from the backer side, it's just a completely different equation. Are you backing this because you want to get something cool, or are you backing it because you want to get some money out of it? In either case, probably a big part of the equation is you're backing it because you want the game to succeed. So that's also like part of the equation no matter what. But the other side of it's very different.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the developer side, you know, there's really no way to do this unless you use one of those platforms. So I think that you're sort of, there's a bit of a gatekeeper issue there, and that you have to do it through a platform like Fig.
Yeah. Do you think we'll see other platforms go the investment route, or do you think there's just too many, I guess, legal loopholes or quagmires to go through to kind of change direction now?
I don't think many of the existing platforms will shift into there. I know Kickstarter has specifically said they don't want to. Mm-hmm. I think Indiegogo actually has started to do some, or is thinking about it, but I haven't kept a watch on that too closely. But I think, you know, if you're a game developer and you want to do it, Fig is probably the easiest one to use right now, just because they have a solid reputation and have done this a few times, and so they have a bit of a track record. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's always possible that more will spring up in the future. It's hard to say whether or not it's the best route to go forward, because you are then getting into bigger issues. You're getting more investors. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll probably take a few years before like a lot of the norms around what all that means shake out. So until then, it's a little bit of an unknown.
Yeah. Now, here's a question. I'm not sure if you've already technically answered this one, but it's something that I've been curious about. When it comes to game development, this is something that we have talked to many developers about over the years. Obviously, game design is not an exact science. We have seen games radically transform from beginning to end, sometimes by necessity, sometimes simply because the developer went over their own skill set. And one of the biggest changes in terms of how game development has happened is with the level of transparency, and especially, as we've said, with Kickstarter and crowdfunding now allowing people to essentially pay in to see this development happen. And my question for you, Colin, is on the legal side of things, if a developer promises in their crowdfunding saying, I am going to build a 8 to 10 hour long action adventure game, let's say set in space or whatever, and when everything is all said and done, that doesn't happen. Maybe it's only a 5 hour game. Maybe it doesn't even take place in space anymore. But basically, what they promise is not happening. Are there legal ramifications on that side when the design doesn't match what was promised?
Yeah, so that's sort of getting into consumer protection issues, specifically of, you know, is the product that you bought what you thought it was going to be? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that goes back to the discussion we were having earlier, where if it's drastically different and there's no communication around it, then yes, there's a potential that you could be sued for releasing something that is drastically different, and you'll want to have protected yourself through forming an entity, through forming an entity. But again, you should never get that.
Yeah.
You should communicate that proactively. You should bring people with you on that journey. If you actually release a good game and it's drastically different than what you promised, I would be very, very surprised if anybody would sue you for that. It's, you know, hearing the stories of what people have gotten away with and just, you know, the people that literally just haven't released anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're so far removed from that scenario that it wouldn't be my main concern.
All right. Now, here's another one of those questions. I think this will either be a very short or very long answer. And I think this is more basically like a dumb question for me that I want to ask you, Colin. And that is, when it comes to the platforms themselves, so Indiegogo, Kickstarter, Fig, and I don't know if we can include Patreon on this point, but the question is, when something like, as we said, when catastrophic happens, you know, complete failure of the crowdfunding campaign, developer, you know, ran off and, you know, they disappeared, they went into the mountains and never came out. Are the platforms themselves liable in any way to when this happens?
Yeah. So I'm not going to answer for the Patreon side of that, but I'll answer for like the Kickstarter Indiegogo side of that. The way that the platforms have set up their terms of service, they definitely disclaim any liability there. Mm-hmm. And again, this gets into a very murky area of sort of consumer protection law and who is the party that you're actually purchasing it from. It's always possible that somebody could say, no, I believed that I was purchasing this game from Kickstarter and not from this developer, and could try to make that argument, and they could try to take that to court. Mm-hmm. Realistically, and you know, this sort of gets to a larger question of like litigation in the United States. You can sue anybody for anything. It doesn't mean you're going to succeed, but you could try. So I don't think anybody would succeed on that argument. I don't think that anybody would be successful in suing Kickstarter, Indiegogo, or any platforms like that that are doing crowdfunding, just because they have set those expectations very clearly. They do have that language in their terms of use that says this is a relationship between the campaign and the backers, not between the backers and the platform.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that I think is likely to be an issue. There was a very brief time, maybe when some of those first few very dramatic failures started coming out, that there was a lot of questions about this, like who's going to be responsible. And I think just based on what we saw, that all of the attorney general investigations were looking into the campaign owners themselves, not into the platforms. All of the lawsuits and everything else that happened were always targeting the campaign owners and not the platforms. So I think we've, just in terms of the expectations that we've seen in the space for the past few years and sort of the precedence that we've seen, it's not likely that that's going to shift. And I think at this point, we're sort of past that question.
All right. Now, before we begin to move on, this will kind of help frame the next set of questions for you, Colin, but have you done any research or have you any thoughts on kind of issues we've seen lately with regards to fair use, be it from content creator sides or from people trying to make fan-made games?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is an area that I'm always passionate mm-hmm. about, and I'm actually on a panel of talking about this at TwitchCon mm-hmm. Later on Saturday. But there's like a lot of answers in here, and it's so dependent on the specific situations and everything that it's hard to give blanket answers. In general, when people are relying on fair use, it's not going to be a good situation, especially for game developers, because as a game developer, you're pouring your heart and soul into something. You're spending literally years of your life trying to develop a game. And if a central part of that game is based on someone else's intellectual property, even if you're using it in a way that you think is protected by fair use, it's a risk that you probably don't want to take.
Mm-hmm.
The tougher question, I think, is, you know, if you maybe aren't in game development specifically, but you're making a podcast or a YouTube video or maybe you're promoting your game and you decide to do an advertisement that makes fun of something, or, you know, you use something where there's some sort of level of fair use. Those are situations where it gets trickier. Maybe you can get away with it. Maybe you can't. I would just generally advise game developers to stay away from fair use in game development. And if you're asking about it for like other scenarios, it's going to be very dependent on the situation. It's going to be very dependent on the rights holder's attitude and how they approach this. You know, like streaming games is probably a great example here. Nintendo and some other developers and publishers, not so hot on streaming games. A lot of other developers, completely okay with it. So it's really dependent on the rights holder as much as it is on the law. Yeah.
Now, speaking about that example, that takes me to a really interesting question for you, Colin, and something that I've been wondering now for like the last few years. As we've seen, I'm sure this could even lead to its own major topic, a lot of the major legal arguments when it comes to the various aspects of the video game industry, be it game preservation, digital sales, and whatnot, haven't really been settled in court yet. Like, there hasn't been an official ruling to say what is and what isn't acceptable. And when it comes to this idea of streaming, again, fair use, as you said, it is very much on a case-by-case basis. Do you think we will ever see, or do you think there will be signs of some kind of official ruling from the court saying, you know, this is fair use, this should be allowed forever, or this isn't fair use, you can't do this anymore?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I know even within the legal community and a lot of the attorneys that I know that work with game developers, there's various opinions on both, you know, whether it is fair use or not, and whether or not it'll be decided by a court at some point. I think it's probably likely to be decided in some aspect in court at some point. The problem is that and this is an issue with just like the law in general. Until you have two people that are properly incentivized to really bring this all the way, you're not likely to see a definitive answer. Mm-hmm. So you need a scenario where you have a game developer that has significant amount of money to bring this case and take it all the way. So it's probably going to be a Nintendo or something like that. And then you also need to have somebody on the other side willing to fight for it. Which, you know, most streamers are not making fight Nintendo all the way to Supreme Court money. So You know, that's going to be an interesting question, and it might end up being, you know, like a pro bono case or something where a few attorneys just decide they really want to test this and take it all the way. But it's not something I'm holding my breath for, but I definitely think it could happen at some point, especially because streaming games has become so popular, especially in the, you know, just really the past 5 years even.
Definitely.
So it's, you know, it's, we're now at the point where we will potentially be seeing some of those cases. In terms of where that shakes out eventually, that's a tougher question. And I think so much of it depends on the specific case that's being argued, the what sort of streams we're talking about. You know, is the person doing the streaming just playing the game? Is the person doing the streaming adding something on top of that? Is it about the commentary? Is it about the interaction? Do they, you know, is there anything like what it could even come down literally to how much of the screen is the game versus how much of it is the person? Can you hear the audio of the game, or is it all the person talking and, you know, other things? Is it, you know, all kinds of random pop-ups and stuff coming up on the game stream, like interfering with the experience of the game, but adding to the potential fair use because that's like the interaction of the people watching and interaction with the streamer? Or is it focused on the game? Is it an entire game being streamed start to finish and it's a 30-hour narrative epic? Or is this, you know, somebody streaming the same map in PUBG over and over every night, you know, just in various, you know, without, you know, really getting into any narrative issues. So there's just so many factors here that it's really tough. And I'm, so that's like even a secondary question is when it is eventually decided, if it's decided, how much will that even be able to decide it for the whole industry, or will it continue to have all kinds of gray areas? And it probably will continue to have all kinds of gray areas because that's the law.
Now, this next question, again, as we said at the beginning, neither of us are providing legal counsel in any which way, but it's something that I was generally curious about with you, Colin. And as we know, by the time this podcast shows up, it will probably be already a few months since this incident happened. But of course, big famous YouTuber PewDiePie got in trouble with the developer Campo Santo for an incident he did while playing PUBG. And following that, Campo Santo basically enacted the DMCA, or I think Digital Media Copyright Act, against PewDiePie for his videos on Firewatch. And there was a lot of discussion as to whether or not that was legally, legally acceptable to do, because the developer originally said that they said, you know, that our game was free for everyone to stream or record. I guess from a legal standpoint, and again, I'm sure there's going to be more opinion than actual legal fact, what did you make of that case or that situation?
Yeah. So I'll actually start this answer by referencing another attorney, Ryan Mortensen, who he does a podcast called Robot Congress, and he did a really great in-depth exploration of this topic right after it happened. And that's sort of like a good legal analysis of it. I think there's the other side of it from, and this is where it really delves into opinion, is should we be doing that just as, you know, like as a norm within our community? Should we say we're going to be using the technical limits of the law to enforce other things? And that's a tougher question. You know, personally, as an attorney, especially, I think I've described myself as if I have to choose an alignment in D&D, it's, you know, a little bit more towards lawful neutral. I appreciate following the rules for the sake of following the rules sometimes, and I don't like seeing the DMCA used to enforce things that are not strictly related to copyright. So even though Campo Santo had the right to enforce their copyright in this way, the fact that they were using it as a tool, not because they were worried about copyright infringement, but more because they were worried about their association with PewDiePie, that rubbed me the wrong way.
And I think I would agree with that too, Colin, that it's okay to, you know, voice your disagreement, voice your disapproval, but when you're kind of using the law in a way that wasn't originally intended to suit your attitude, it does kind of seem like, you know, you're breaking your, it's basically like two wrongs don't make a right kind of situation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's an accurate way of looking at it. Yeah.
Now, again, I am sure there are many more legal-related questions we can talk about, and we could easily turn this into like an hour and a half, two-hour podcast, like it's nothing. But we'll try to keep things again to like about an hour, maybe hour five, because I'm sure you – are you able to like say if we do go a little bit later, or do you have to get going soon?
No, I can stay as long as you need.
Awesome. I don't think you should have said that, Colin. That may be trouble for you, but we'll see. But getting back to this topic, or actually, this is a really interesting question. As you said, when it comes to streaming and fair use, that it's really up to the copyright holder in terms of what they will and what they won't allow. And I'm just wondering, and I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm sure you'll be able to put it much more eloquently than I am. Why are some developers a lot more, I guess, strict or restrictive when it comes to their content? As you mentioned, Nintendo is a very big example. They have really gone on the record saying that if you try to stream any of our games, you are not going to get any kind of ad revenue for it, you know, no matter what you do to it.
Yeah. So I'm actually going to sort of place myself in their shoes and make the argument that they make just because I've heard it. I don't necessarily agree with it, but, you know, just to relate that so we have that as a starting point for the discussion. The way that they talk about it is they want to sort of control how people experience their games. They don't want it to be, you know, watching someone else play it. They want it to be playing it themselves. Also, I think there's some fears around for some of these narrative games, if you're watching it through somebody else, do you need to buy it and play it yourself? You know, maybe not. All that said, I think one of the clear differentiators between some of the developers and publishers that I've seen that have been very strict on this and those who have not is actually a cultural one rather than what I would consider like a strong business reason, and that's Japanese developers and publishers versus non-Japanese developers and publishers. And I think that gets to Japan's approach to copyright a little bit. It's a much more serious thing to have copyright infringement in Japan. It's actually pretty common to see criminal enforcement for copyright infringement there. And, you know, I think that's, I don't really know how that came about in terms of the cultural aspects of it, but it's definitely seen as a more serious offense there. And just in general, game developers and publishers from Japan definitely aren't as cool with streaming. Mm-hmm. So for whatever reason, that cultural issue has sort of that's been the main divide that I've seen.
All right. Yeah, and I've definitely heard cases, as you mentioned, Persona 5 being one of the more famous ones lately about that. And that actually gives me a good segue into a question that I've heard this many times before, and now that I'm actually talking to someone who knows law, I really want to ask this to you, Colin. Is it true when it comes to copyright claims and copyright infringement that the copyright holder must defend or go after any like attacks or anyone trying to make use of that copyright illegally? Like they must fight every battle or they could lose that copyright?
So not for copyright. Okay. For copyright, there's no concerns over that. There is an element of that for trademark, and it's a little bit different. Like that's sort of the way that a lot of people talk about it. The higher level concern is trademark is all about consumer protection, actually, rather than protecting the company. in reality, you know, it's a company that's enforcing trademark rights, and it's the company that gets most of the benefit from them in a lot of ways. But the idea is that as a consumer, if you walk into a grocery store and you pick up a can of soda and it says Coca-Cola in the distinct, you know, writing and logo of Coca-Cola, and then it has a tiny little disclaimer, not actually Coca-Cola, you know, made by PepsiCo or something, that's not enough to inform you. You can like rely on the trademark to know what you're buying. So as a consumer protection tool, if you have let, as it like as a company, if you have let other people use your mark in other contexts and consumers are no longer confused, like they no longer think that your mark is an exclusive thing associated with you, then it gradually gets weaker and you gradually lose some of that protection. And especially within, you know, maybe specific contexts, if somebody, if you've let somebody use your mark in a potentially infringing way, and it's gradually weakened in that specific way, then if you like start going in trying to enforce it, you have a weaker argument there to say that, oh, consumers don't understand that this couldn't, this could potentially be somebody else. You know, the counter argument would be, well, actually for the past 20 years, it's become very clear that other people are using this mark in this context and consumers are not confused by that. So you can't prevent people from using it in that context. So that's where it all sort of comes from. I think that it's often used in an abusive way where people will try to push it a little bit harder than it needs to be pushed and try to protect uses that maybe don't need as much protecting. And then it also gets into like how you enforce it. So I think there's actually been a trend from a lot of more consumer savvy and friendly companies that they understand that they can enforce their trademarks, but they can do it in a way that doesn't come off as them being the asshole in the situation. And, you know, just letting people know, this is our trademark, please don't use it, thank you, rather than sending a very formal, legalese-filled cease and desist.
Yeah, and that is always, again, as we've said, a lot of these situations haven't been officially determined in a court yet, and it'll be very interesting if that happens. And speaking about trying to defend your trademark and some of the challenge when it comes to the video game industry, there is one situation that I really want to get your thoughts on, Colin, because it's one that we've been seeing more and more the last few years. And that has to do with games that are being pulled off of stores due to the licensing running out or being altered in a way that changes from its original intent. And there are several big examples of this over the last few years. There have been games that have been pulled that featured brand characters. There's, I think, the Deadpool game that was pulled off of store shelves. There was the infamous Grand Theft Auto, I think it was 4, that because they had to patch the game, which meant working on it again, that they didn't have the trademark, or I'm sorry, the licensing for those songs, and they all had to be removed. And then very recently, there was a Mickey Mouse Castle of Illusion that, again, because the game had to be updated and they couldn't get the licensing from Disney again, the game could no longer be sold. And I'm just wondering, again, with your experience, what do you make of these cases where a game or some entity has to be altered, but in a way it's basically infringing on the licensing because they no longer have it?
Yeah. I mean, I'll actually approach this from a different way. I think this is a licensing problem. Yeah. It's very tough sometimes when you're thinking about contracts to plan for every situation, but at the end of the day, that's what an attorney's job is when they're writing these contracts and thinking about, you know, what the purpose of that agreement is for, is what are all the potential situations this will have to cover, and how do we make sure that everybody's needs are met going forward? So, you know, if you're a game developer getting a license for something, then that the attorney drafting that agreement should make sure that you're getting a license for everything that you need. It's obviously very complicated, and that's why you get things like this where something slips through the crack and something has to be removed or can't be updated or whatever the situation might be. But that's really the solution, is making sure that you do have that license in place, because obviously there's plenty of other situations where people did have the proper license in place and didn't have to deal with these situations. And that's, you know, generally to the benefit of everybody. Yeah. But then, you know, you do get situations like this where it wasn't the proper license, and for whatever reason, the rights holder doesn't want to extend that license again, or isn't willing to without getting compensated for it. And it's unfortunate, but it happens. Yeah.
Is there like an actual like legal term, or like for a developer listening to this, like something they should tell like an attorney if they're drafting up a licensing agreement, to keep this stuff in mind when it comes to, you know, future development or having to support a game beyond the original, I guess, development of it?
Yeah. Not necessarily a specific term. I would say this is an area where it really pays to work with an attorney that knows video games specifically. The breadth of fields that licensing touches is pretty large, and you do not want to be working with an attorney who knows licensing but doesn't know video games, because they will be writing an agreement for something that may not serve you. So just making sure that you work with an attorney that actually knows what your concerns are. And then if you have, like, it's the attorney's job to ask you those questions and make sure that they're accounting for all of those uses. But if there's something that you are doing that is just truly outside the ordinary in the video game world, then probably mentioning that to the attorney to make sure that they know that you're doing that. But you know, typically that's something that the attorney would dig up.
Yeah, definitely solid advice there, Colin. And again, for those of you listening, we are not doing this in a legal standpoint, so please definitely consult a lawyer if you have questions regarding this. Now, let me see. I believe, at least for today, I have one, I guess, category of questions left to ask you, Colin, and then I'll turn over to you to see if there's anything else you'd like to discuss, and then we'll probably wrap things up then. But one thing that I've been curious about, and for longtime fans of Game Wisdom, you know that I'm definitely a proponent of game preservation and being able to keep these games, or being able to keep playing video games way past their shelf life. And over the years, we have seen discussions regarding the preservation work of these games and some of the challenges, and in many cases, the legal issues that come about when you're trying to keep these games going. And I guess the first part of this question is, when it comes to, like, obviously we are talking about games in some cases that are over 30 years old. Is there I know when it comes to music or like popular culture, there is a point when it basically becomes, I guess, public domain. For video games, is there like any like point in the law where that happens? When, let's say, a game is so old that, you know, someone can now just take that source code and, you know, make it run on every platform they get their hands on?
Yeah, so there is, and it's all tied back into copyright law. So copyright is the primary mechanism through which games are protected, and typically the main issue that you see coming up. There's definitely trademark issues as well that can potentially cause problems, but those are also very easy to work around. You know, if you have a game that otherwise works fine and you have the licenses for, and the trademark holder doesn't want you to do something with it, you can literally just rename the game and do all the same things you're going to do before and not have a problem. But copyright's very, very difficult to get around. So copyright comes into the public domain currently, I believe it's 75 years after the death of the author, or 90 years after the first publication date for a collective work, which is what a lot of video games are, because they're often done under an entity with lots of contributors. So that's just a really, really long time frame. And that's an issue that I think the entire creative industry has been struggling with. This is ironically an area where Disney has pushed this quite a bit. There's actually a joke among people that are concerned about the length of copyright, that every time Mickey Mouse comes up for or potentially is about to lose protection as a copyrightable character, Disney lobbies Congress to push out the length of copyright. And it's like one of those painful jokes because it's sort of true as well. And it really sucks because it's good to have things come back into the public domain. You know, Sherlock Holmes is a great example. There's elements of Sherlock Holmes that are new and are protected by copyright, but the original stories are in the public domain. You can write a Sherlock Holmes fan fiction about some of those early books or involving elements from those early books, and that is completely within your rights to do. Or you can make a game about Sherlock Holmes and do that, and it's completely within your rights to do. And not necessarily legal advice there, but you know, in general, like the public domain is valuable for game developers in that sense. Mm-hmm. In the context of preservation, I think there's also other elements to it. Obviously, with a law as it is, you're not going to be dealing with the sunsetting of copyright in a serious way to think about like game preservation. You know, even if for the games that are 30 years old, they still have 60 more years before we're even going to get those into the public domain, and you know, there's a good chance all of us will be dead by then. So, you know, let's not rely on that as the way to keep these things accessible. But there are other elements. So there are some release valves to allow for games to be preserved for the sake of preservation, and actually just works in general. And I'm not really an expert on those, and so I can't speak to like a good level of detail there, but I know that there's ways that fair use and the DMCA allow for some level of preservation of these works. Mm-hmm. And that's on the legal level, and then also on the practical level. Most people dealing with games which have these sort of lost copyrights, if you can't track down the rights holder, it's unlikely that somebody's going to like come after you for trying to preserve it, especially if you're not trying to make money off of that.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen cases with like GOG, for instance, they've had trouble because they're obviously trying to sell these digital remasters of these older games, so they can't find the copyright holder. And as you said, it can get very crazy when the company folds and, you know, it goes to someone who bought a piece of the company and then traded it to someone else and so on and so forth. And it can become very challenging. And as you said, for a lot of people who are interested in preserving these video games, it's not from a monetary point of view. They just want to make sure these games are still playable. But there's always that challenge, and as you were talking about things from like Nintendo's point of view and the other company's point of view, I guess it's my turn, that people who hold on to these trademarks or the copyright, they know, or they always have that feeling that, you know, this could potentially become something big. You know, we see it all the time with developers or older games being remade or these characters being brought back. I mean, earlier this year, to everyone's surprise, we're getting a new Bubsy game, and no one was really asking for that. But you just never know. And this could probably be a really good beginning wrapper for this podcast, but one of the challenges of the game industry is that you never know what's going to be the next big thing. And because of that, it's very hard to set standards and regulations for it. I mean, getting back to the first part of this podcast, Kickstarter is a brilliant example of this. I remember back in 2012 when I heard about it, I was like, yeah, I mean, it sounds great, but it just sounds way too tricky to do games with. I mean, who's going to really do this? And then I said the same thing about Steam several years before that. And the same goes for video games. And I'm sure you can attest to this as well, Colin, for every game that comes out that fails, there's an even smaller percent of a game that just blows up. And you never know which game is going to do that.
Yeah, and I think this actually gets into another area where it's useful to treat every game as a business. Yes. and get proper legal advice as you're setting that business up. This doesn't have to be a huge investment, but talking to an attorney about it, making sure that you have an entity, making sure that if you're working with other people, you have some form of agreement with them in writing. Mm-hmm. you know, these are very basic things which anybody can do. It doesn't cost a lot of money. And if you're spending a lot of time and effort on something, you know, that is money too. Time is money. So if you're spending years of your life, you can probably spend some money to get an attorney to help you as well.
Definitely. And as I'm sure anyone listening to this can attest to, money does change things when it comes to working with people. And you really do have to take these steps to protect yourself and your business. And I think what you just said, Colin, is a really good point. And this is especially true for a lot of first-time developers, especially those that come out of college, that they don't treat this as a business. And I just spoke to some developers about this earlier this week, and I'm sure I'm going to speak to many more over the years to come, that this is a business. At the end of the day, if you want to succeed making video games, you have to treat it as such. Because if you don't, all these things can come back to hurt you. And again, I can think of many little horror stories I have of talking to people who don't view video games as a business. And it's very unlikely they're going to make a game, much less so a game that's actually profitable.
Yeah. And I want to touch on that other point you made as well about money changing things, that is really such an important thing to keep in mind. I had a great contracts professor in law school that sometimes talked about contracts as being equivalent to a marriage. Everybody goes into it with great intentions. They think it's going to last forever. They think it's going to be wonderful. And they're not worried about, you know, getting divorced or anything like that, or having to rely on any of these terms. But at the end of the day, you know, it might be 10 years later, you're now, you know, co-founder of a massive game developer. And it could be that contract you signed 10 years ago that determines how much of that company you own or how much money you make from that game. And it's important to just invest some level for like that possibility of success and that possibility of success changing the equation or having some level of falling out. You know, ideally everybody loves each other and nobody argues, but there's going to be that time when something bad happens, and it's not even anybody's fault necessarily. It could just be like shifting priorities. Like you see this in startups as well so much. You have multiple people going into a venture with the best of intentions, and then one person is, you know, having their first child, for example, and they can no longer afford to live the startup life, and they have to get a, you know, quote unquote real job to pay the bills. But they've also put a year of their life into this thing, and they also want something out of it. And then you have to like go through this tricky divorce and figure out like how much they get for it, how much you get for it, how do you divide all these things. And if you haven't spent the time up front to, you know, lay out just the basic level of an agreement there, then there's nothing to work off of. Yeah. And it makes everything else so much harder.
Mm-hmm. And I think for people listening to this podcast, I think the defining lesson for today is talk to a lawyer when you're thinking about getting into the game industry.
Absolutely.
I think if we could have a banner up right now, we would be displaying it. Let me see. We talked about game preservation. There's one part of this I want to talk about. I think you may have answered this already, but I do want to clarify. When it comes to working to emulate or preserve these video games, there have been discussions regarding people who have to use hacks or pirated copies or some way to basically get around any kind of issue with the game. And to give you an example of this, there are many older games that required either that had a copy protection that no longer works or simply because there's no longer an authentication server to do that. And in those situations when you have to use something that's, you know, quote unquote, not entirely legal for it, does that change things when it comes to the preservation?
So there are some safety valves in the DMCA that allow for getting around things in order to have access to them for preservation purposes. Again, it's not an area that I know well enough to really to speak of in detail. But I think in general, for most people doing this on their own or, you know, in a community where nobody's making any money off of it, you know, again, not legal advice, but probably nobody's going to come after you for that. If you're trying to make money off of something and you're involved with any sort of discussion about, like, is it, like, should I, you know, circumvent this DRM or whatever it might be, you're definitely going to want to talk to a lawyer about that.
Mm-hmm. And that actually leads to one other question, and then I think I may just be out of questions for tonight, but we'll see. But this kind of goes back to what we were saying with the whole Campo Santo Firewatch situation. And some, at least with some of the older games, especially on the PC side, we have seen cases where a developer will make a game open source, or they'll basically allow someone to work with this game or work with the files, you know, carte blanche, basically. When that happens, like, let's say it's a IP that no one thought was going to be popular, and then it comes back, I don't know, like 15, 20 years after it, can the copyright or the trademark holder go after the people who use the open source files of that game?
So let me just make sure that I'm understanding the question correctly. Mm-hmm. You're saying that if somebody makes something open source, like the copyright owner makes something open source, can they then change their mind 10 years later after it's become super popular and say, actually, never mind? So, no, but I'll caveat that by saying that it depends on how they did it. So there are actually very defined licenses used in the open source community. And if somebody is using those licenses, then they are legally binding in the sense that you're giving, like, you're promising through that license, it's a contractual agreement for all intents and purposes, that somebody else can use it in the ways that you lay out. Mm-hmm. So as long as you're doing that, then yes, you can follow those licenses and you can use it, and you don't have to worry about whether or not they're going to change their mind about open sourcing that. That said, there's definitely people that do that in a messy way, or, you know, they don't use the license, or they just sort of say, this is open source, but they don't actually have a license attached to it, or, you know, maybe there are restrictions in the open source license that aren't being followed by the developer using that code. And so, like, a very common example of this is for some open source, it requires that any code built on that remain open sourced as well. And if you then try to make something proprietary out of that that you're then selling, then that would be that wouldn't be allowed by that license. So there's definitely a lot of intricacies there that it's hard to, like, capture, but in a general sense, you can typically rely on those licenses.
I just thought of one other really big question that's been happening lately that I won't get your thoughts on, Colin. And then I think I'll have to, you know, muzzle myself before I think of anything else. But one of the bigger things we've seen over the last few years, especially from the PC side, is the money that's going into mods. Now, again, for people listening to this cast, you should know what modding is when it comes to games. We have seen many developers, especially on the PC side, get their start with making a mod to a successful game, be it something as big as a total conversion mod or something as small as making, like, cosmetic hats for Team Fortress or armor in Skyrim and so on. But over the last few years, we've seen developers and publishers trying to market mods themselves. A very big example, what kind of made me think about this, was the whole monetizing Steam Workshop when it came to Skyrim from a few years ago, that the fan outrage from that was so big, it basically collapsed in like 3 days. I remember we did a podcast Friday, and then by Monday, it was already taken down. And then lately, there's been the discussion of the Bethesda Club and having these kinds of paid mods. And I'm just wondering, and I don't know if this is something that you've had too much experience with, Colin, but what kind of, like, legal issues arise from basically having someone work on, like, you know, content for a game and then trying to sell that either through the publisher themselves or having a price tag on their own with it?
Yeah, it's so I think part of the outrage there is also the difference between DLC and mods, yeah, and maybe not really respecting that mm-hmm. that difference in some ways. That's not really necessarily a legal issue. But I definitely think that's where like a lot of the anger comes from, is that people see these developers trying to pass off DLC as like, oh, we're just seeding the modding community or something like that, and it doesn't really ring true. I think it's good to have an ability for modders to be compensated, and if developers and publishers are willing to provide frameworks for modders to do that legally, then I think that's potentially a good thing for the modding community long term. I think the app store is actually a great example of this. You know, Apple released the iPhone, they had this platform that you could do stuff with, and then they just let people build on top of it, and they let people make money on top of that. And now you have hundreds, thousands of companies, some huge multi-billion-dollar companies that make apps for the App Store. And Apple is capturing all of that value. You know, people don't buy the iPhone just for the hardware. They buy it for the whole package. So I think if developers and publishers are willing to create that sort of ecosystem so that modders can really support themselves doing modding full-time, that's absolutely fantastic for those modders as creators themselves, and for the game that they're modding for. I think it's obviously a very tricky problem to navigate in terms of how you message that, how you talk to the players about that and the community about that. But if they do it effectively, I definitely think there's potential for it. Of course, the other side to it is that they could just sort of turn a blind eye to modders doing it themselves, but you know, from a legal standpoint, that keeps things in a very amateur state. Nobody's going to be building a $1 billion company on modding if it's another company turning a blind eye on their copyrights. They need that legal framework in order to have a level of certainty that they can actually do this legally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. I'm sure we'll be seeing more of this as time goes on, especially when we've been starting to see this idea of pushing mods and user-created content onto console games as well. And of course, like one of the biggest examples of that kind of creative content would be something like Minecraft, which I can't even begin to imagine how much of that game has been people just altering it and just adding their own stuff to it.
Yeah. And I think it's important to remember when you're thinking about sort of like the user backlash against a lot of these paid mods is the value question. A lot of the times what we've seen here is, you know, the $5 horse armor and things like that, where people just, they look at it and this is not the value they expect to get for something. If you're paying $5 for an amazing app on the App Store that transforms how you use your iPhone, you are getting value for that. Yeah. You don't complain about, oh, this wasn't for worth $5. What the hell are you talking about? Yeah. You know, if you paid $5 for a total conversion mod that gave you 30 hours of new gameplay and was practically a new game, nobody's going to complain about that.
Yes.
It's all about how you position and the value for that. And I think there's going to be lots of difficult and interesting conversations about that going forward. But I do hope that we see more of it in the future, because I think it helps support a really vibrant community of modders.
Yeah. And we are definitely above or going over our hour limit for this cast.
Right.
And I can think of at least like three or four more major topics to jump off to. But I figure I have one, I guess, question to my voice is starting to die as well, which is also a good sign to wrap things up. But I have one question that will kind of like tie a ribbon on our podcast, and we will say goodnight. But Colin, again, it has been a pleasure talking with you, and I would love to do this again, either record or maybe even do something live, because I am sure there are plenty of indie developers who have questions, and as long as we put up the "this is not legal" counsel flag, we can maybe talk about
it. Yeah, no, absolutely. It was a pleasure as well, Josh.
All right. So here's my last question, and then I'll turn things over to you to see if there's anything else you want to discuss or end the cast on. But again, this, I think, hopefully this should be a very simple question. But this is something that I've talked about before, and I just want to clarify with someone who has studied law. When it comes to gameplay itself, the mechanics and systems of a title, that kind of work or that kind of content cannot be copyrighted, right? In terms of, let's say, I have a mechanic that lets me, I don't know, do a backflip when I press a button. Like, that kind of stuff cannot be copyrighted. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the way that copyright is separated out is it's the expression, not the idea itself. The other side of that, though, is patents, and you can patent an idea itself, or at least the sort of the technical implementation of it. Okay. So that's why you do see some patents in the game space. Fortunately, I think, for game developers, we haven't seen a lot of patent enforcement in the game space. You know, I don't necessarily ever want to tell people to just ignore them completely, but at the same time, you know, most people aren't going after indie developers because they're violating a patent. So it's not something I would spend a lot of time worrying about.
And again, if we want to talk more about the philosophical side of this, we'll be here for another 40 minutes easily. And if I forget this, like the next time we get a chance to talk, Colin, I definitely want to talk about digital ownership and digital sales of games, because that's an easy another hour, especially if we have people on asking us about it as well. But to end the cast, or at least end our discussion for now, are there any topics that we didn't touch on that you would like to bring up, or anything you want to say to kind of, I guess, wrap or end the cast on?
Yeah. I mean, I think we really touched on this multiple times throughout the podcast, but treat game development as a business. Yeah. You don't have to invest a huge amount up front, but make sure that you have agreements in place. Make sure that when you're working with other people, especially, you are have something in writing. You know, once you're spending a significant amount of time or money on a project, and especially once you're interacting with other people around that, make sure that you have an entity in place. You know, talk to an attorney in the game industry. Most of the attorneys that I know that are in the game industry are both really awesome, passionate gamers who love working with indie developers, and they're also usually willing to give an indie developer a bit of free time to talk through the general issues and explain what they might want to be thinking about. And they also often will offer very reasonable starting packages. You know, most people that are working with indie developers are not in it for the money. They're in it because they love games, and they're more than willing to find a way to work with you. So, yeah, definitely treat it as a business and talk to an attorney.
Yeah, but great. And if you get a chance, Colin, any like links to popular websites that deal with legal counsel for games, that would be great to send over, and I'll put them in the description below.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. So, again, for those of you listening, we could talk about any number of topics when it comes to the legal side of the game industry. Because as we said at the start, a lot of this is not really discussed in the public space. And as Colin just put it really well, these are elements you have to think about, especially when you're trying to run a game studio, be it a 2 to 3 man operation or, you know, 20, 30 people plus. And as Colin eloquently put it, you have to treat this as a business. And we could probably get that somewhere emblazoned and to show people. But hopefully we can do this again real soon, Colin. But again, thank you so much for coming on. And thank you again. Again, it's just a very enlightening conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Josh. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem. So, for those of you listening, we're going to end things here for this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom and what I do, there are several options available. You can follow me on Twitter at GWBicer for updates throughout the day. If you'd like to write a piece for the site or be a future guest for our discussions, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. Check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel for daily videos discussing game industry topics and Let's Plays and spotlights of a variety of games. And I guess as a perfect capper with Colin being head of legal at Patreon, you can also support my Patreon, patreon.com/GWBicer. Your donations can help to keep things going, get access to our private Discord channel, and a lot more. So check that out. And with that said, thank you so much for tuning into this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and I will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.